Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with my co-host, Juwona June Thiessen. Today is Thursday, December 18, 2014. And we're on to a new schedule now where we're pre-recording rather than doing it live because of changes at the station. So it's a little bit different for us, but Juwona, I think we're going to get through it okay.
Yes, I think we will because, it'll work really nicely. I'm happy that we actually have the opportunity to pre-record.
Oh, me too. It actually helps us because even though our audience is hearing this on Thursday, it means we get to do this when we want to during the week. It makes it a lot easier for our schedules.
Yes, exactly. Because by the time they are hearing this recording, I'll be on a cruise to the Bahamas.
Ooh,
hey.
Talk about LOA.
Ooh. I know. So I'm excited about that.
How long are you guys going to be away?
7 days.
7 days.
I know. It's
and you're
awesome.
You're taking your parents, aren't you?
I am, yes. Yeah. So Mark and I and my parents, all four of us, are going. So.
They must be excited too, I would imagine.
They are. It's their first cruise, and yeah, they don't even know what to expect.
Well, I'm sure it's got to be better than standing around in 2 inches of snow with their jackets on, like they were
Absolutely. In
that photo that you had on Facebook.
For sure.
Being the Trinidadians that they are.
For anybody, I think that'd be better, even if you weren't Trinidadian.
Absolutely. So anyway, this week we are doing a book review, and that's going to be a relatively new, relatively ongoing feature that we'll do on and off for the show. And this was a selection you decided to make this week. You want to, why don't you tell the audience who we are reviewing and what book and why you decided to pick it?
So we are going to review The Power of Positive Thinking by
Ooh,
Norman Vincent Peale.
A classic.
Yes, and, you know, it's written a long time ago, but it was only recently after I started learning about and practicing LOA that I realized that a lot of the principles of LOA have been around for a long time, and people like Norman Vincent Peale have been writing about, talking, preaching about these principles. And so his book is kind of like a gateway into LOA for, especially for those with the Christian orientation. So
mm-hmm.
A great book to start with.
Yeah, I noticed that the first edition was published the year before I was born. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know how old I am, so you can
right,
tell it goes
yes.
way back.
Now all our listeners are going to look up when it was written.
Well, if they're going to look up just to find out how old I am, they need to get a life, I can tell you that. No, seriously. But I was looking over the book, and because mm-hmm. I hadn't seen it, I hadn't read it in quite some time, and I was reminded, like you mentioned, it's got a very strong Christian orientation to it.
Yes.
He relies heavily on Scripture in making a lot of the points that he has to make. But he also was a groundbreaker because he was introducing a lot of the concepts that we now associate with the Law of Attraction as it's presented through The Secret, through Abraham Hicks, through a number of the other leading authors and speakers and contributors in the genre. So he was definitely ahead of his time in that way.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I learned recently. So that's why I'm so happy that we can, you know, kind of review the book. Because for me, too, it's a review. I had read it before, but then reading it again, I was like, wow, you know, all this LOA stuff is not that new after all. So
yeah. Right. Yeah. And in fact, I had kind of forgotten all the different ways that he had touched on the new faith, if you will, the Law of Attraction side of it.
Right. Yeah, which was really new then when he started talking about it.
Yeah.
But he was really, you know, did a great job explaining it in a very practical way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when I first read it, because I didn't have the background of understanding that I have now, mm-hmm. I think I kind of skimmed over some of that stuff, to be honest.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's so easy to do it. I mean, any time that you run into something that doesn't really make a lot of sense to you, you don't quite understand it, you skip it, you know, you just kind of skim
right.
it.
So I think I read all of it, but I may not have understood all of it. It sounds like a nice fairy tale, but it didn't at the time seem very real and practical because it was so different. It was so different from, one, the Christianity that I had been raised in, and two, it was so different from what everybody else was talking and saying and believing. It really was groundbreaking.
It was, yes. And it has challenged the faith of lots of people over the years. To this day, I think it still continues to do so, particularly among those who are strong, fervent in their Christian beliefs. It's a very challenging set of ideas. It fits. I mean, he draws heavily from Scripture in order to make his points, mm-hmm. but it's a different take than what you normally get in a typical Christian church. So, yeah, in that sense, quite revolutionary. One of the things I noted was I think it was one of the first chapters, maybe even the first chapter, he itemized what he calls 10 simple workable rules for overcoming inadequacy attitudes. Inadequacy attitude, that's quite a phrase.
Yes.
yeah, and he was basically...
Sounds like a nice thing, but it isn't.
yeah. I think it's called spin. But
right.
But, yeah, he was addressing the whole concept of self-confidence because according to a survey that apparently was taken around the time that he wrote the book, I think it was something like 75% of all undergraduates rated lack of self-confidence as their number one personal problem, which is actually quite indicative of the 1950s when you think about it. But it's also quite remarkable because at that time, being that honest about what was going on inside was not de rigueur.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it was a time where you lived on the surface because that's where everybody lived, and it was relatively unsafe not to. You were out on the bleeding edge if you decided to actually express true feelings or behave in a true manner rather than in the societally justified, societally approved and sanctioned way to behave. Yeah.
And you know what I found interesting, you know, rereading the book the second time, you know, his whole thesis is instilling self-confidence and the idea that no matter what circumstances you're faced with in your life, you have the resources within you to actually deal with them and actually succumb them and be successful. But, you know, there was a period, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago, maybe sooner, where the emphasis was on self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And he stressed self-confidence. And I have to admit there was a time I didn't even think about it enough to realize that there was a difference between the two terms.
Mm.
You know, self-esteem is, as I see it, is more of a relative term, you know, feeling good about yourself compared to others, you know, that kind of thing. But self-confidence is just an inner belief in yourself, in your abilities, regardless of, you know, what's happening or who you're with or around. And so he really stresses that self-confidence, to give you the faith, the hope, you know, he uses a lot of those kinds of biblical terms that no matter what's happening to you, you can overcome it. You can be successful. It will turn out okay in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if we look at those 10 simple workable rules, as he styled them, working through that list, it's right out of an LOA book. I mean, let me just read them to you. First one is formulate and stamp indelibly on your mind a mental picture of yourself as succeeding. I mean, is that LOA or what?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely.
Second one, whenever a negative thought concerning your personal powers comes to mind, deliberately voice a positive thought to cancel it out.
Yep.
Right out of the LOA playbook. Third one, do not build up obstacles in your imagination. Depreciate every so-called obstacle. Minimize them. Difficulties must be studied and efficiently dealt with to be eliminated, but they must be seen for only what they are. They must not be inflated by fear thoughts. Wow. That just says it right there. Then number four, do not be awestruck by other people. That's what you were talking about for a moment there. And don't be awestruck by them and try to copy them. Nobody can be you as efficiently as you can. Interesting word, efficiently. Remember also that most people, despite their confident appearance and demeanor, are often as scared as you are and as doubtful of themselves. And
right.
That makes you think of that survey he talked about where 75% of undergraduates said self-confidence was their number one issue. It really plays up how what he's describing there is the 1950s. I mean, that's exactly the way the mentality was at that time.
Yeah.
Number
and
five.
Somehow I don't think much has changed.
Yeah, well, I think it's improved, but I think in many ways you're right. There is a lot of continuity going on there.
Right, because I think there might be more free, people are freer to express themselves and be who they are, but I think it also then allows them to more efficiently mask their own feelings of insecurity, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there might be still those insecure feelings going on, but they can, you know, there's so many outlets. There's, you know, social media and all these other things that can kind of distract from that fact. And so it doesn't appear to be detriment as serious as it probably was in the 1950s. I don't know, just what I think.
Well, I think you make a valid point. In fact, I would go so far as to say that we live in the age of emotional unraveling, where people are working through their own thoughts and feelings and coming into direct contact with and coming to terms with themselves on the inside in a way that they've never done before. And of course, to go through all that, you have to go through the emotional unraveling. You have to work your way through and even find where your own blocks are and your own resistances are, often blocks and resistances that you don't even know or didn't even know were there in the first place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's part of what we're going through right now as a society.
Yes, and that brings me to one of the other things I liked about what Norman Vincent Peale talked about, which was the power of a peaceful mind. And he goes on to explain that, you know, before you can start having true self-confidence, you have to first empty your mind of all the doubts and all the fears, all the guilt, all the regrets, you know, all the things that are, you know, the leaks in your personal strength, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the little things that are eating away at your own sense of self-confidence. And so he's saying that you have to empty your mind of those things. And in the book, he talks about how he, on a cruise, he was one of the speakers on a cruise, and he actually advised those on the cruise to, after the gathering, to go out on the ship. What is that called when you go stand, you know, you can see the water.
On deck.
On deck. And actually mentally picture yourself emptying your mind and throwing all your fears, all your insecurities, all your doubts, all your envy, all the negative thoughts, and just, you know, picture yourself throwing them overboard and getting rid of them, you know. And, you know, and he was saying that people actually tried it, and it was more powerful than they realized that it could be. And so he really stresses emptying your mind and finding that peace, because that's where the power comes, the power to then face the challenges and face the obstacles and face whatever else may come. Because it is when we face those things with all the doubts, we feel, oh my goodness, there's no way I can deal with this. You know, look at what happened before, or I'm not good enough, or whatever it is that may make you so afraid and kind of, you know, step back from life. And he's saying that, you know, getting rid of that can really increase your personal power, and I personally like that.
So I have to ask you, with that setup, I mean, you basically set yourself up here. So you're going on a cruise next week. You're going to have a chance to go on deck. Are you going to try it?
Absolutely. You know I am.
Among other things, you're going to come back and you're going to know perfectly well what it means to be up on top of the ship. You're going to say, when I'm on deck, because you were on deck.
Yes, exactly. Right. I'll have firsthand experience.
Yeah, but that's going to be fun. When you come back, you got to tell us what you went through when you tried it and what the experience was, how it worked out. Because now you have a chance to directly test something that he taught in his book.
Yes, definitely. Yes. Oh, yeah. I plan on doing it, too. Yeah.
This is a wonderful opportunity. Plus, it's a great opportunity to de-stress, which is a good thing.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, because, you know, I think that's kind of what a lot of people have in mind when they go on cruise, is, you know, not specifically casting all their fears, which is kind of getting away and escaping and forgetting everything. Whether that happens or not, you know, is debatable, but I think that's the whole draw of a cruise for a lot of people.
By the way, a little tidbit for you, a little tip for travel. When you're on the cruise ship and you're on deck and you're going through the gyrations of mentally throwing all the stuff off the boat, mm-hmm. and somebody walks by and gives you a quizzical look, just say, oh, I'm emulating Norman Vincent Peale.
Yeah, that would be a start of a very nice conversation, I think.
I would think it would be. Because they'll say, what?
Right. And then I can tell them all about, you know, LOA and the power of positive thinking.
Yes. Hey, that becomes part of my conversation on a regular basis. I even have clients who are devout conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. that I'm working with right now. And I don't press my viewpoint with them, but I've got one of them to the point where he anticipates that I'm going to mention something about LOA. He
calls really?
Yeah, he calls it sowing and reaping because that fits more closely with the Christian dogma. But
right,
you know,
I see. Uh-huh.
But he's totally on board with that's where I'm going, and he's okay with it. You know, so I've learned how to be an evangelist without even evangelizing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a great opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have that opportunity every day of our lives. How many people do we run into who don't understand this stuff
mm-hmm.
on
yeah.
a regular daily basis? I mean,
yeah, that's always surprising. Well, I shouldn't say that's surprising because there was a time when I didn't understand it. But yeah, you just want to say, you know, there's this great theory, there's this great law that if you would just, but no. Yeah, I think, you know, just trying to practice it in my everyday life is the struggle.
That's a big thing, yeah. Yeah, and in fact, many of the best teachers of the law of attraction and of the spiritual side of it will often tell us that the best way to help other people is by living by example, showing them the example in yourself, and then other people pick up on it, either through direct conversation or indirectly, just through emulation.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to actually kind of pass on the knowledge.
Right, so it's not like we have to worry about, you know, organizing a movement.
Right, true, yes. Yeah, we are indirectly, which is good.
Thank goodness, I might add on top of that.
Right, I know, yeah, because with all we have to do already, that adding something else to the list.
Somehow I can't see us walking down Fifth Avenue in New York with banners saying, LOA, LOA.
Right. Oh, that may not go over so well.
But anyway, getting back to Norman.
Yes.
I was touching on his 10 points. The fifth one actually is where mm-hmm. he starts getting into the Christian side. He draws from Romans 8:31. Mm-hmm. If God be for us, who can be against us? And he says, repeat that 10 times a day. And he even puts in parentheses, stop reading it and repeat them now, slowly and confidently. So he was very serious. He wanted to take that very, very seriously. And it kind of makes sense, really. I mean, the phrase itself, if God be for us, who can be against us, it's a Christian way to do it. And I'm not always partial to the Christian way to do it. Mm-hmm. But it's a way of saying, we're all part of God.
Yes.
So what do we have to fear?
Right. Yeah, I like the fact that the book is so very practical, but
yes.
that phrase in particular, that Bible text, it, you know, for me now it means, in addition to the fact that, you know, we don't have anything to worry about, but I like to think of it as the universe is kind. The universe is kind.
It's
you know,
a
that
good
is,
universe. Yes.
It's a good universe. Yes. And it's on my side and I'm going to be okay, you know, so it's something that, you know, we are taught maybe we're told consciously, but whether we actually believe that, you know, it's a different story because there's supposedly so much evidence to the contrary that gets promoted. The evidence to the contrary gets promoted, but the evidence in support of that, you know, most people don't talk about it.
I think perhaps the most interesting part of that is that the people who do the promoting do not see themselves as fear mongers.
Mm.
You notice that?
Mm. Yeah.
And yet they are. That's precisely
right.
what they are.
They are, clearly.
Yeah. And you pointed out to them, I've actually tried this a few times, and the results can be fascinating. You have to, of course, get yourself into a very positive and balanced frame of mind and very low-key, you know, non-threatening and so forth, and then gently point out, you know, you realize what you're doing here is you're promoting fear.
Mm-hmm.
And you get really interesting looks when you do that because people do a double take.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't really thought about it that way. And most of the people who you are pointing that out to don't really want to be fear-mongers. So it makes them stop and say, gee, what am I doing here? Yeah. And they may continue to defend it. They may continue to carry on the activity. But now at least you've thrown a cog into the assembly. You've thrown thrown sand into the cog is what you've really done. So now that whole fear mechanism isn't working like it did before.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that, I think we're all guilty of that at some time or another. I know I am. And
it's so easy to do.
It's so easy to do. It's so much a part of the culture and how you were raised and, your family, the TV, school, you were taught to be on the lookout. Look out for the risks and the possible failures and the flops and all the dangers, you were trained to do that. So you are, I remember as I, grew from adolescent into teenager and then young adulthood, that I was proud of myself that I could, identify the risks. I thought that was a good thing. Yeah. Because the grown-ups did it, so I felt, okay, now I'm doing what the grown-ups do. So,
yeah, there you go.
Right. I must have. I must be maturing. It's so sad, but you really have to be vigilant of your own self and what you are promoting to kind of.
On the other hand, that's a reason for being so glad because we've learned the importance of doing it.
Yes.
And we've learned to become aware of it and conscious of it.
Yeah.
So that's actually a pat on the back territory.
Yes. Yep.
Now, his next point that he makes here, mm-hmm. again, very much in line with the modern LOA movement. Get a competent counselor to help you understand why you do what you do. Boy, is that what we were just talking about or what?
Yeah, definitely. Yes.
Learn the origin of your inferiority and self-doubt feelings, which often begin in childhood. I think you just mentioned that.
Yes. Right.
Self-knowledge leads to a cure. Wow. Mm.
So, look at all this powerful stuff this guy was writing about in the 1950s.
Yeah. And look how, without realizing it, you could have written it. I mean, you just basically wrote that paragraph before I wrote it to you.
Yeah, that's true. But, it took me a long time to come to that realization.
Well, I'm pretty sure he didn't write it when he was a teenager.
Right, that's true.
So he probably had to go through the same kind of thing, just with perhaps less support. But
Yeah.
That's the real kudos going out to people who were able to make these observations and come to these places of understanding in an era where the understanding was considered taboo.
Yes. In fact, I did a quick Wikipedia search of Norman Vincent Peale today.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I learned, some interesting things. Of course, I probably thought he did, but he had a lot of critics. And not just, naysayers, but of course a lot of Christians, leaders.
Surprise, surprise.
Did not agree with his theology. But more close to home, he had a partner who was a psychiatrist, and they had established this a program to help people overcome depression and other mental illness, that combined psychiatry and spirituality and positive psychology, as it was called, as it was referred to. And I guess the guy, the psychiatrist, got so much pressure from his medical profession that he actually, he ended his relationship with Norman Vincent Peale, and he kind of distanced himself from him.
So sad.
And really sad. And, but Norman, he kept on, just doing what he was doing and kept on preaching what he was preaching because he knew that it was actually helping a lot of people. So, he faced a lot of obstacles himself.
Yeah. And that's what makes his achievement all the more remarkable.
Yes. Yeah.
It really does. So anyway, moving on to step 7. He mm-hmm. says, step 7, this is one of those 10 times a day practice things. He says, repeat the following affirmation out loud if possible. He says, I can do all things through Christ which strengthened me. That's from Philippians 4:13.
Yes, I learned that as a child.
And I would personally translate that to, I can do all things because I am part of spirit and it strengthens me.
Yes, that would be a good...
It's the same, basically the same equivalent idea.
Absolutely, yeah. That's, when I say it, when I repeat it, I you know, those are the ideas that I think to myself now, too.
The sentence that he adds at the end of this point is a really good indicator of the times he was in. He says, that magic statement is the most powerful antidote on earth to inferiority thoughts. The fact is, at that time, that would have been considered a magic statement.
Yes.
That's really something.
Yeah. And I think too, that period, an antidote was a popular thing. People were looking for all kinds of antidotes.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
That was readily available to anyone, free of charge. That probably was really good.
Mm-hmm. Then number 8, he says, make a true estimate of your own ability. Boy, isn't that something we all need to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tricky one.
And then he says, raise it 10%.
10 times, yes.
Wow. There's a challenge. He's basically saying, aim for higher than what you believe in yourself.
Yeah.
That's really something. But he says, do not become egotistical, but develop a wholesome self-respect. Believe in your own God-released powers.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I would put it, believe in the fact that you are a part of God.
Yes. Spirit is with working with and through you.
Yep. That's right. And then number 9, put yourself in God's hands. To do that, simply state, I am in God's hands. Well, that's pretty straightforward. Then believe you are now receiving all the power you need. Feel it flowing into you. Affirm that the kingdom of God is within you, Luke 17:21, in the form of adequate power to meet life's demands. Now, this is an interesting one for me,
mm-hmm.
especially the part about feel it flowing into you. Mm. Because if you had said that to me, and I'm sure this was true at the time that I first read this, if you had said that to me, say, even 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would have thought you were nuts.
Mm.
Because the idea of feeling it was nuts.
Okay.
Because I couldn't feel it. If I couldn't feel it, then it can't be real. So this is just somebody creating some sort of, you know, fantasy. Okay. It's not real.
So what's changed?
That's a good question. I was thinking about that as I was bringing it up. What exactly has changed? I think what's changed is that I have had two things happen.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I've been through enough difficult times, particularly, and a lot of people have, I'm not mm-hmm. the only one, particularly since 2008. And those difficult times really challenged me spiritually to the point where I had to start finding new answers beyond what I used to have, because the answers I had spiritually before were pretty limited, to say the least,
mm-hmm.
and totally inadequate to the task of helping me get through the tough times.
Yeah.
So because of that, I had to reevaluate, and I was at that point therefore more open to the idea of being influenced by the unseen and being able to, quote, feel, unquote, that which I couldn't feel.
Yeah.
And because my mind opened up, that led to step 2, which was I kind of started to try it in a way, in sort of limited ways, and began to realize that at times I actually could feel it, much to my surprise.
Yeah.
One of the best ways I found fairly early on in my study of all this stuff was when Louise and I started experimenting with a technique that we found. It was a page that came out of a Reiki therapy book. And it was basically about helping to move energy through your body for healing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So we followed the step-by-step that they were doing. And as I started to follow the step-by-step, I was doing it on her. And I was holding my hand close to her head at the time because she had a headache. So we're going to use it to see, can we get rid of a headache?
Yeah.
And as I was holding my hand above the spot on her head where she said she was feeling the pain, I felt this amazing tingling in my palm. I mean, it was palpable. This was not like an imaginary thing. This was like, whoa, what was that? Was that like an electric current or something? And I pulled my hand away, and it was gone. I put my hand up next to it, and it was there again. It was like feeling a magnetic field, if you will. It had that kind of a tingly feel, and it had sort of like a motion feel. Like if I moved my hand, the field would move to address where my hand was now hovering.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to describe, but if you've ever felt an electronic field emanating from a charged wire, that gives you a sense of what it feels like. It feels very much like that. And that surprised me. I didn't realize that I could feel that kind of a palpable sensation off of a human body, which electronically speaking gives off maybe like a volt or two of power. We're not talking about huge amounts of power. It's certainly not a whole lot of amperage.
Mm-hmm.
No, so it's not like it would be likely for me to be able to detect through my touch a current of some kind. And yet I was definitely experiencing some kind of a current.
Yeah.
Now, you can call that what you want. I think that was a spiritual current. And I can feel that almost on demand now.
Really?
We've gone through this so many times now that, especially if I know somebody has some kind of a pain or something that's bothering them on their body, if I hover my hand over that spot, I can almost always, maybe like 95% of the time, feel a field of energy over that spot. And by helping to sweep that away, I can help alleviate the pain. Now, why is that? I don't know, but I know I can do it.
It's very interesting. You know, when you said that you 7-8 years ago would be, you know, kind of disbelieving of that statement, mm-hmm. I found that very surprising. Not that I don't, just that I didn't, because I've always, for me, feeling was always so much a part of my life, you know?
Oh.
I always felt everything, you know? So I didn't even think twice about that statement. It never occurred to me.
Interesting.
That there were people who, you know, for whom that statement would not ring true. Yeah, that's very interesting.
I actually think it probably is something that occurs a lot more to men than to women.
That's probably true, too.
Because of the training we get to bury our feelings. We're not allowed to show feelings in the traditional stereotype. The stereotype is we're supposed to be the strong, silent ones, right?
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Certainly not supposed to show any kind of weakness feelings. Any feelings we do show is supposed to be powerful and strong and confident and all that kind of stuff.
Right,
you know, in order to accomplish that, you have to bury a lot of feelings.
Yeah, you know, actually, conversely, you know, growing up in the Caribbean islands and going to a church that's, you know, black, of course, and Caribbean, you know, feelings was a large part of worship.
Okay.
And so, you know, you kind of almost at least once a week felt, quote unquote, God move in you, through you, or, you know, something of that nature. Yeah, so I thought it happened to everybody at some point.
Well, listen, we're past time to take a break. Let's take a break, and then after, let's continue on that, because I want to ask you a little bit more about that, okay?
Okay.
All right, so here we go. This is LOA Today here on PRN. We'll be back after these messages. And we're back here on LOA Today, Walt Thiessen and Ioana June Thiessen on this Thursday evening talking about Norman Vincent Peale and the Power of Positive Thinking, the book that was published in 1956. Yes, you can do the math now compared to the first part of the show if you were listening. And you made an interesting statement before the break, Ioana. You mentioned that when you were being brought up in the church that you were brought up in Trinidad, that everything about the worship experience there was feeling-based. And so I have to ask, mm-hmm. We know what kind of an impact the Christian church can have, both positively and negatively, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how does particularly, well, both sides, how does the positive side and how does the negative side manifest itself, and particularly the negative side, how does it use the feelings to try to control and to influence and you know, maintain its hold on you?
Oh, that's, I don't know if I want to share that because I have some very strong
feelings. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I don't want to push
no,
you.
No, I can.
That's too tough.
No, so I know that, on the negative side now, looking on it, you know, when I do go to church, I can see how, the feeling, the emotions are used to, sometimes very manipulatively to influence people to do whatever the leader, speaker, person in charge wants done. You know, so, mm-hmm. For example, if you're at, you know, I remember being at the, what we call the evangelistic meetings where you would invite non-Christians to come and, you know, they would be preached to. And so with the end goal of them giving their life to Christ, and, you know, so there was a lot of emotion involved in that, because at the end of the sermon, there was a lot of, there was what is called an altar call. And so, you know, the pastor would be telling you, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. And So that was negative because there was a lot of fear-based emotion involved with that.
So how did that play out from an LOA perspective? Because I would imagine that, as with everything else where the law of attraction is concerned, the more that you focus on a belief or a thought pattern, the more you tend to manifest similar things with similar vibrations to that belief or thought pattern. So how did that play out for you in that sense?
So you kind of lived in this constant fear of, you know, doing the wrong thing, of sinning, of offending God, of making a mistake. You know, it was, because you kind of got this image of God as some powerful being in the sky who was just waiting for you to mess up and
punish
you as a result. And so, that was not a good place. It's just not a good place, especially when you're a teenager growing up. You already have your own issues. Add to that the fear that God is going to strike you down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was a negative side. But on the positive side, there was lots of positive emotions associated with the worship service. There was the positive community, the togetherness. Everybody really liked and cared about each other, and that was always a great feeling. You know, we had great friends and, you know, members that we just really looked forward to seeing and, you know, share life and do things with. But also, for example, there was the music, you know, there was a lot of singing and praise and worship music that I, to this day, that is like my best part of the worship,
you know.
My favorite reason for going to church, because, you know, you are, the music, if you allow it, it transports you outside of yourself, outside of your life and all the, you know, issues that you might be dealing with. And you kind of go to that place of gratitude and appreciation for life and all the good things that you are experiencing or have experienced. But also it inspires a sense of awe in you that, you know, that you're not alone, that there is a God and He is, you know, mindful of you when you can communicate with Him. And, you know, that was always a good feeling. And, when you go to the black church, the music is like out of this world, you know, people music on the radio, it doesn't even compare. But, when you for me now, I hear that and I hear the quality of the music and I know that these musicians have, are outside of ego, if you understand what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, they've gone to a different place, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to go there with them because it becomes about something bigger, something larger, something more powerful, something more meaningful than the regular mundane activities of your life. And just everybody is left better for having shared and experienced it. So that's one of the positive sides, you know.
Okay, well, what you're talking about, I think, feeds in, and this is partly why I asked about it. It feeds into what we were talking about earlier about how Norman Vincent Peale was in many ways outside of the religious social caste and received a lot of resistance at the time that he was alive, received consternation, criticism, to the point where, as you pointed out, his associate,
psychiatrist,
actually felt so pressured that he had to distance himself from Peale in order to maintain his place in society.
Right. Yeah.
So when you talk about the positive feeling and the negative feeling of services as you remember them when you were growing up in Trinidad, it makes me think. You talked on the negative side about how they were really tying you in and making you feel, you know, so afraid and so on and so forth. But on the positive side, there was the music and so on and so forth, and that made you feel really good. Here comes Norman Vincent Peale along in the 1950s, teaching that all we should focus on is the positive side.
Yeah.
In the face of an entire society, particularly a religious society, that focused heavily on damnation, on fearing God, on fearing the church, of being subservient. And no wonder he got attacked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's surprising that he even was as successful as he was,
yeah.
you know, doing what he was, given that he was a minister, you know, that was his, you know, main profession.
Right.
He was the minister of the Gospels. So, yeah, that was kind of.
Which means he also was being pressured. He was being pressured within religious circles.
Right, definitely. Yeah, they talked about that, how a lot of people felt that his message was too, I don't know, what the, I forgot the term, but too light and flowery or something, you know, feel good. You know, and it didn't get to the heart of the matter, which was, you know, our sinfulness and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Incidentally, you know, here in Florida, we, you know, the car we're driving, we have Sirius satellite radio, and we get, there's a minister by the name of Joel Osteen. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I haven't, no.
But he preaches a very similar message to Norman Vincent Peale.
Oh.
As a radio station and a TV program and all the, and you know, and he is known as the positive preacher. And,
really?
Yes, and he gets a lot of flack from other ministers who feel that, you know, what he's preaching is not true gospel, quote unquote. But he's got millions of followers.
In one sentence, one statement anyway, I think you've shown how, number one, our society has shifted because he's got millions of followers, and number two, parts of society are still stuck in the 1950s.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's a better day for him than it was for Peel, that's for sure.
That is absolutely true. Millions of followers for a preacher in Florida.
No, he's in Texas.
Oh, he's in Texas.
That's better or worse.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, he's based in Texas, but his program is nationwide.
It is nationwide. Oh, okay. So I was going to say, that would be really impressive if it was a local population that, of that size. That'd be, wow.
No. That would be really awesome.
Something you mentioned earlier about Peel, he emphasizes the idea of a peaceful mind, and indeed the title of his second chapter is A Peaceful Mind Generates Power.
Power. I just love that statement.
Interesting phrase, a peaceful mind generates power. I mean, that ties in very nicely with the whole idea of the power of now and the power of just staying in the now and not allowing yourself to be drawn into the, you know, the bad past or the good past or drawn into what the future might be, just staying right here and now and mentioning and, in fact, emphasizing that that is a powerful place to be in. And it really is, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, you know, and this is my third time kind of encountering this phrase, you know, once when I read the book several years ago, then I read it recently, and then today getting ready for the broadcast. You know, every time I really kind of think about it a little bit, I learn so much more about that, and I realized that it's when your mind is peaceful that you can access the part of you that has the ability, the creativity, the insight, the wisdom, you know, all the thing that makes a person powerful. When you are afraid and worried and, you know, whatever else it is, you know, if your mind is anything but peaceful, you cannot access those things. And so you're very powerless. But once you can clear, you know, make a path through that, you realize just how powerful you actually can be, you know, and that in itself is empowering.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. One of the things that makes Peel's book so appealing
wow,
is the fact that, like any good storyteller, he tells good stories. In fact, the book is chock full of stories.
Right.
And indeed, he prefers to teach via stories, both Bible stories and by secular stories from his own time, from people that he knew at the time. I mean, we could draw from any number of them. One that kind of comes to my mind, and I can't remember what part of the book it is, so unfortunately I can't direct you to the right page, the right chapter and verse, so to speak. But he tells the story of a man and woman who came to him saying that, I'm sorry, that's another story, of a man who came to him who claimed that he had lost everything.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Peel asked him, well, I mean, what values do you have left over? And the man said, you don't understand. I lost everything. I am completely ruined for life. I'm wiped out.
Yeah.
And so Peel sat down with him and got out a piece of paper and says, how's your health? Oh, it's good. My health is fine. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wrote that down. And are you married? Oh, yes. I could never have gotten through this without my wife. So he wrote that down. Do you have children? Oh, my children are wonderful. They've been so supportive. They're willing to help me through whatever it's going to take to get through this. Oh, okay. So he wrote that down. When he was done, he had 7 items on the paper that were all positive virtues. He pushed the paper across the table and said to the man, well, there's 7 assets you have right now. Yeah. And he looked at it, and he had this very sheepish look on his face and realized that he had kind of overspoke.
Yeah.
And went forth, and from that point on, started to turn his life around because now he had a positive way of looking at it. The power of emphasizing the virtues we have right now, the assets, the good things in our life right now, is something that certainly Christianity has pushed, but and Peel, as a Christian preacher, he was obviously going to push it, but he really emphasized it in a great way with that story.
Yeah, and hence the name of the book.
Yes.
But yes. I really, I think he has a chapter in there that's called Expect the Best. Yeah, something like that. But, you know, in there, it's talking about your perspective and how important that is, you know. Just like with that man in the story, he helped him to have a completely different perspective on his life and what he still had and all the good things, you know. It's something that, you know, we can all do and all benefit from, regardless of what our situation is, because no matter how dire we might think, there's still always something that we can look to and be appreciative of, and then that would then give us, some kind of clarity of mind to kind of go forth and try to make the best of the situation and even, you know, find a way to overcome it. But it all starts with, you know, your outlook and how you see things. And so many of us, we were never told that, you know, nobody taught us that's an option, first of all. And then when we realize it's an option, it's a skill that you kind of have to kind of acquire. And there are no classes in college, that teaches you how to do this and how to do it well, and even how knowing that it's possible. But it's another thing when you actually try to, you know, implement it in your life. It does take some time and some, you know, there are easier and not so easy ways of going about it. Because I know for me, having a partner that shares my belief and shares my desire to kind of implement these things in my life makes it so much easier. You know? Nobody told me this.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you found out, though.
Yes. Oh, yeah, the hard way.
Or the easy way, depending on how you want to look at it.
That's true.
Because you and Mark have this great relationship.
Yes.
But the chapter
I was saying hard because I suffered, relationships that weren't so easy before that.
Yep. The chapter you were referring to is indeed called Expect the Best. In fact, the full title is Expect the Best and Get It.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very LOA concept. This is chapter 7 in the book. And, indeed, it starts off with a story about a boy who failed at everything until he discovered one simple phrase. And shortly afterward, he had risen to a man of tremendous influence and power. Mm-hmm. And when Peel asked him about it, he said it's because he found a Bible verse that worked. And the Bible verse was, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth.
Yes.
Well, there's LOA right there.
LOA, all the way, every
right
day.
Right there. Yeah, that's it. Belief is all of it. I talked earlier about how 7 or 8 years ago I would have had trouble with this. That was one of the things I had the most trouble with, the idea that belief actually makes a difference. It just didn't seem to add up for me. If you had said to me at that time, all I have to do is believe, I would have not believed you.
Isn't that something?
Isn't it?
And you know, that's very true, because we have been taught and brainwashed into believing, for want of a different word, that only what you can see and feel and touch and hear matters.
Yes.
So everything else is, you know, of no consequence. And so we don't realize the power of our thoughts, the power of, you know, what we believe, even as one of the things that Peel talks about, the power of the words that we speak with to ourselves, to each other, you know. And so we discount that. And, you know, that was one of the revelations for me coming to, you know, becoming a student of LOA, is realizing just how much more important everything other than what my five senses can detect is, you know? So the things outside of the material world, basically.
Yeah.
So that's where the secrets are. But I was, you know, I spent most of my life focusing on the things that were material because I thought that was it. And, you know, anybody who said differently must, you know, be crazy or something, you know. And so coming to realize that, you know, life is probably 10% the material and 90% the immaterial things, the things you can't see, things you can't touch, like your thoughts and your words and, you know, the energy that you're sending out and all those things that makes so much of a difference. It's really amazing.
In fact, I would say that the biggest challenge is to not be drawn into reacting to what the world gives you for feedback and to rely on that as what as a determinant of what you're going to focus on and thereby attract more of into your life. In fact, the challenge is to focus on the stuff that you want, even though it's not what you're seeing, though what you're seeing perhaps even contradicts what it is that you're trying to attract. That's the real challenge.
Yes,
it's an amazingly difficult challenge, in part because you first have to come to the realization that it works. It actually is truth, that you have more power focusing on what you can't see than on what you can see.
Yeah.
That's really something that's just mind-boggling.
It doesn't make sense. And, you know,
yeah, on the face of it, you say, that's nonsense. That's crazy. But as it turns out, that's where our greatest power is. We are actually least powerful when we're spending our time focused on the seeable and the feelable.
Right. Yeah, so true. And for me, realizing that there's so many people who, you know, I shouldn't say so many people, but a lot of the people who are successful, they got that. They figured it out. They learned it. Whether someone taught it to them or they figured it out themselves, they got that. And that's what they've used to help them become successful.
Yeah. And for many of them, they don't fully understand that other people don't have the same viewpoint.
Yes. That's true. That's like me not realizing that not everybody, you know, emotions and feelings, something with, you know, always a part of their lives. I didn't realize that. But you're right. Yeah, for a lot of people, they're like, wait a minute, they don't actually know this?
It reminds me of a conversation I had, a non-LOA conversation, non-spiritual conversation that I had one time about a year ago with someone who, like me, is an online marketer. And is in the business of providing consulting to businesses who are trying to do marketing online. And one of the things that this person mentioned was her shock that the average online internet marketer does not engage in testing. The reason she was so shocked is because she came from a corporate environment, and actually her experience was unusual because most corporate marketing groups don't engage in testing either.
Really?
But the one she came from did, and they would not have made a single move in terms of putting out a new marketing initiative of some kind without testing it first to see how well the market was going to respond to it. So from her perspective, the whole idea that there could be marketers who are trying to put out stuff that they think the market's going to eat up without actually testing it was mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So there's even a much more mundane example of the same thing. What you focus on as a regular, patterned, habitual manner of thought can become so ingrained that it almost becomes impossible to think that anyone else could think another way.
Definitely, yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
So let's see, we've got only about I would say about 3 minutes left, maybe 4 minutes left that we can actively use. But let's call it 3 minutes just to be safe. Let's see if we can try to tie all this up. I don't know how you tie Norman Vincent Peale up. But let's see if we can find some way to tie it up. If you had to put your finger on one most important lesson you got out of rereading the book, what do you think that would be?
I think it is the idea of self-confidence. You know, every so often I re-encounter the term and I think about it and I come to a little bit different understanding of it. But the understanding that no matter what circumstances I may face or encounter, that I have the resources to deal with them. I mm-hmm. have what it takes to overcome, to be successful, to make the best of it. I have it. Because, you know, so many times when the crises come, you know, you're like, oh my goodness, this is it. I'm ruined. This is the end. There's nothing I can do. You know, and then you face another one. But keeping them in mind that, you know what, I can deal with this. I've dealt with other things in the past, and then there'll be other things in the future that I can overcome it. And, you know, like the text says, you know, with Christ and all things, I can, you know, be an overcomer. So that was one of the things that was really, was a good reminder for me today.
Okay, that's good. The thing I guess I would follow up on that with is the idea that because all of this is, in a sense, self-prophecy, in that the thing that we focus on most commonly, that becomes belief. Mm-hmm. Belief is, as Abraham Hicks says, belief is a thought you think continuously or often or regularly.
Yeah.
And because of that, even if we come from a place where we're used to being in negative space, thinking in negative space, thinking by default, we can change that a lot more easily than we might suspect simply by making the effort to focus on the positives in our lives as often as we can.
Yes. Norman talks about the happiness habit.
Yes.
Just like better habits, brushing our teeth, whatever it is, we can create, we can have our own happiness habit. Yeah.
And in my own case, I have to say, it took quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a lot of time to get more and more into the habit of focusing on the positive. Even when I wanted to, even when I was making it a major initiative early on, I still found that I spent a lot of time on the negative. So it took me a while. Other people, they can probably do it in 5 minutes. But for me, it took me quite a long time. But you can do it.
You can.
It doesn't take effort. It just takes continuity. It takes just repeatedly applying it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest lesson of all. Well, Ioana, it's been a pleasure as usual, and
absolutely.
I think we did Dr. Peel a good deed today. What do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think he would be proud.
All right. Well, then we'll leave it there, and we'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. It might